I'm Angry, and this is Q and Angry, the follow-up podcast. Today, I'm following up the article that I published in Early Access last week, and for the rest of the world this week, called The Anatomy of a Game. It's a part of my ongoing True Scenario Designery course on making the best adventures, campaigns, and encounters you possibly can. This particular article was also part two in a three-part chunk of articles that I'm calling like intro to basic game design. We're just talking the very, very basic game design concepts here. I'm introducing ideas that I will be exploring again and again and again and again and again and again and again throughout the course. Okay. Now, also, for those of you who are new to the whole Q and Angry thing, because I think this is only the third time I'm doing it this way, from this point forward, when I put out an article for Early Access, I'm also putting a thread up in the Discord for anyone who is a member of the Discord because they financially support theangrygm.com. Anyone in the Discord can go into that thread and ask questions. The thread will be there for about a week, and then I close down the thread, and those are the questions combined with the comments on the site and any discussion that happens that I will be answering and responding to in these follow-up threads. So the very best way, if you have a question, to get it answered is to use that thread. And if there are no questions in that thread by the day where I need to do the scripting for the podcast, then there's not going to be an episode. It's just going to be a quick episode that's, hi, I'm angry, there are no questions. Womp, 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 womp. Anyway, so back to the article. This is, as I said, The Anatomy of a Game. And in this article, I gave a brief survey of four things that form what I'm considering to be the basic definition of a tabletop role-playing game or scenario. Because remember, scenario design is game design. The scenario designer assembles the game ingredients into a complete game, which means a scenario designer has to know what a game looks like in order to, you know, assemble things into a game. You have to know what a cake is before you can make a cake. And you have to understand flour, sugar, all of that stuff. So in this one, I talked about four different components that go into a game. Goals, rules, challenges, and context. Of course, I'm not going to reiterate the whole article today. That's not the point of this, but I'm going to respond to some questions that were asked. And I am going to begin by sharing a point that is going to become very important later. And I hinted at this in the article. Okay. In the past, I have been giving instruction to all of you for something like 12 years on my website. And all of that has been basic introductory or explanatory stuff. This is how you run, you know, how you build adventures, yada, yada, yada. And everything I've said is perfectly good advice, especially for adventure building, if you want to build an adventure or an encounter or whatever, it all works, except that it's all kid stuff, okay? As of this series, you are now adults, which means this series is going to be about me telling you Santa isn't real. A lot of you are going to balk at some of the stuff I'm going to say because I'm going to say stuff that I have never said before that in times I have even kind of fought against a little and that no other tabletop role-playing game player or game master in the world will actually say out loud. I said one of them in the article and that is agency isn't real. Player agency is a myth. Okay, player agency is actually part of the Santa that I'm talking about here. Okay, there comes a day when you grow up and you are told Santa Claus isn't real, but also in that you become a conspirator to the Santa lie because you also then understand it's a beautiful lie. And it has to be told. Kids have to be allowed to believe in Santa or the world is a terrible place. Now, as an adult, it is number one, your responsibility to know Santa isn't real and not delude yourself into thinking he is, or else there's going to be no Christmas presents. But number two, to also maintain the lie so that the shining, bright-eyed, happy faces of children will still exist on Christmas morning because you snuck the presents under the tree and you take zero credit for buying them so that they can think a mythical North Pole elf brought them instead. Okay? That's what this is about. And it's important now that you understand you're coming behind the curtain. And I was reminded of a Penn Jillette quote in all of this. Penn Jillette was on an episode of a podcast called Radiolab years ago, where he was discussing a magic trick. Okay? And he talked about the whole revealing how the trick is done and how he doesn't like to reveal the trick, not because he thinks it, like, he doesn't think it ruins the trick. Like, obviously, he's one half of the people who did the transparent cup and balls trick, but rather because most people are let down by being let into the trick. And this is what he says: the only secret in magic, there's only one, and that is that the secret must be ugly. You cannot have a beautiful secret. He clarifies that a beautiful secret's short and sweet, and that it gives you this aha moment when you say it, you know, when you tell someone, oh, this is the secret. It's like just this one thing. He folded it twice, or he, you know, there's a mirror there, or whatever it is. And people go, aha, oh, that is so clever and simple. And they can turn and whisper to someone. And this, so he goes on to say, if I have to say, well, he's lying about this and there's gaffer's tape over behind there and they're not actually telling you the exact truth here, and it gets so you don't get an aha. One of the strongest feelings you can get in life, one of the most rewarding feelings, is the feeling of an aha. I finally understand. If you don't have a wonderful aha, people won't figure it out. So I can't tell you easily how, and it goes on, the quote's not relevant there. Okay, his point is that the secrets behind magic are actually ugly. It's not this beautiful thing like, oh, it's this simple trick where the game designers used lighting to guide you. Okay, it's 10,000 evil, ugly manipulations. The game designers did this, this, and this so that they could trick you into doing this, and they knew exactly where you were going to go, and they actually gave you a quest so that you purposely wouldn't follow it, so that you would think you didn't have to follow you, and all this stuff, and it's ugly. And that is scenario design. Some of you are going to reject it. Some of you are going to get really, really uncomfortable about it. And some of you, when I point this shit out and say things like, well, you can't actually make an open world game, but that's okay because video game designers don't either. Some of you are going to get this ugly feeling in the pit of your stomach and be like, well, that shouldn't be right. I don't like that. I can name a few people who in the Discord had that exact reaction to that exact conversation of, this is really ugly. I don't like this. Well, if that's how you feel, true scenario design is not for you, because Santa isn't real and you have to be part of the lie now. There is no magic in the universe, but you have to keep pretending there is. Welcome to adulthood. So that being said, and that's going to come up in a moment, let me now answer some questions, okay? Ignobility wants to know, because I pointed out that encounters are different when you're designing them versus when you're running them at the table. That is, game masters have to look at encounters completely differently from scenario designers. Ignibi wants to know, what else is different depending on the hat you're wearing? Well, the answer is everything is different. And I talked about this in two lessons ago's Q and Angry, when I pointed out that as a scenario designer, you're sitting above the design and you can take all the time in the world and you can think about this and that, and you can look ahead to the whole plan, whereas when you're the game master sitting at the table, you are basically a deer in traffic and you are just trying to dodge the traffic as it's coming at you. Okay, all you can think about is resolving one action and then the next and then the next and then the next. You really can't put actions in the context of game design. And it's a myth to think you can. Game masters think they can, like, you know, design as they run a game. They can't. So everything is different. It all looks completely different depending on if you're being a scenario designer or if you're being a game designer, to the point where it's worth thinking about yourself as two different people. I don't like the hats analogy. The idea that you can take off your game master hat while you're at the table and put on your scenario designer's hat is bullshit. You cannot, okay? You just can't. You're running the game. You can only focus on resolving the action in front of you, and you shouldn't have to do any more than that because that's enough. Okay. Decurion asked about context, because that fourth thing I mentioned is context, and I explained that context is all the whys and wherefores about why does this goal happen and why these challenges, why this and why that. And Decurion wanted to know whether that includes like fantasy or whether it includes like the world building and the setting, and pointed out that I mentioned themes. And so does that include the narrative? And the answer is yes. I use two very specific words when I describe context. I use the words fantasy with a capital fa and narrative with a capital na. Okay, those are my words now. Remember, I'm using my own terms. They mean what I mean them to mean. When I say fantasy, that refers to all the world building shit, all the simulationist shit, all the things that make the role-playing game world be a world. And when I say narrative, that refers to all of the things that go into making sure the game leads to a satisfying storytelling experience, or, you know, not a collaborative storytelling experience, but make sure that a good narrative emerges from the gameplay. Okay, because those are things you need to make sure happen. They don't just happen on their own. So that is all included in the context, all of it. Everything that is not goals, challenge, rules is the context. Okay. Without context, the goblins are just a stat block. And without context, the quest is just an object, you know, it's just like a task list. Go to this place, get this thing, get this thing, get this thing, you win. Okay? Without the context, that's all the goal is. So, you know, the context is everything else, and it is central to tabletop role-playing games, unlike in other games where you can get away without context. Okay. Decurion also asked about the sidebar, where I mentioned that die rolling is not a challenge, okay, and said specifically, is a die roll not a challenge because if there's an action, or if there's only one method to overcome a challenge and the only thing that it entails is rolling a die, there's no choice, and is it not a challenge because the players don't have any choice? And the answer is yes, that's the basic understanding of it, that, you know, if all you have to do is roll a die, there's no skill involved, but it has nothing to do with the choice, okay? Because the choice will come before the die roll. Okay, if you have a choice between picking the lock and breaking down the door, you have a choice. And presuming that you had to, you know, if there was some criteria to decide which of those two is the better choice for the situation you're in, and you have chosen one or the other, that is the choice. Rolling the die is how you resolve the outcome. The element of challenge is the choice that you made between those two actions. Rolling the die does not challenge you in any way. It's just pick up the die and roll it. Even if you have ways to give yourself modifiers on the die roll, like you say, you know what, I have a lumberjack's axe in my pack. Let's use that to help us break down the door, thus gaining advantage on the check to break down the door. That is part of the choice you made to break down the door. That is not you affecting the die roll, okay? You can't think of it like that way. So You are on the right track there, that the choice is an important element of the challenge, because role-playing games can only challenge you by asking you to make choices. But that's not what makes the die roll not a challenge, because there's not a choice involved in the die roll. It's because the part that was the challenge has already been and gone. I also want to point out, and I said this explicitly in the article, that just because you spell out that, okay, there is a door, it is stuck. It's not locked, it's stuck. And so the players can use a strength check to break it down. And that's the only mechanic you give in the scenario. Remember that that doesn't mean there's only one way to get through the door. It is just that you, as the scenario designer, believe that is the only way that the players are likely to come up with. Okay? That doesn't mean it's the only way. Players can do anything, and I will have a lot more to say about this in the next article. Meanwhile, Decurion and Woosh, by bringing the dice rolling and Candyland into this, because Woosh wanted to know, how is Candyland a game? Because I said Candyland is a game. And this ties into what Decurion just asked about the die rolling, and this ties into my speech about Santa not being real. Okay? So I'm going to explain this to you now. It has been pointed out, and it gets pointed out very frequently, with much the same tone of voice that people say, well, actually, Frankenstein was the scientist. The monster was not named Frankenstein. Okay, this is the same attitude people have when they point out Candyland is not a game. They point out that there is no element of challenge in Candyland. The outcome is predetermined by the cards. Okay, once you shuffle the deck, each player flips a card and it determines where they move to next. The cards are already in order. All the players do is reveal one card and then another and then another, and then they move that number of spaces. There's no choices to make. There's nothing other than flipping a card. It's exactly the same if it's just a roll and move race, right? That's basically all it is, but it's not even that, because the pile of cards is already predetermined. So people point out there's no element of challenge there. There is not a game there, except, and this is really important, this goes to the whole Santa Claus thing, there is a game there. And the reason there's a game there is because people think it's a game. It's as simple as that. People playing Candyland think they're playing a game. And this is not a pedantical, nonsensical, like technicality argument. This is not a sandwich argument. This is not a hot dog is not a sandwich argument. This is a much more important argument. And that is, what makes a game is actually the psychological response people have to it. People respond psychologically differently to games than they do to other activities. And Candyland evokes the psychological response to gameplay that other things do. So all of the wonderful definitions about how you need challenges and goals and rules, yada, 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 and there is no challenge in Candyland, is for naught in this case, because you can have a game that isn't a game and yet is a game. See also most casino games, which are basically just games of chance. We actually have a whole term of it, games of chance, which are basically games where the outcome is random. It's just, you know, see what happens. Spin the spinner and, you know, whatever. No strategy, no challenge, no nothing. And yet people still think of them as games, okay? There's two reasons why this happens. And as a game designer, you should be aware of this, because this is also why most people will respond to die rolling as if it is a challenge. If you say, okay, the way past the door is you can attempt to break it with an athletics check, DC 25, and then somebody rolls the die, and then they get it, they will think they won, even though they had no choice. The only option you gave them was an athletics check, and then they rolled the die. Okay, here are the two reasons. First of all, and they both have to do with human evolution. Okay, the first reason is that human beings have evolved to use tools to such an intuitive degree that human beings cannot figure out where the brain doesn't know where tools end and people begin. Okay, this is why driving becomes second nature, why it becomes muscle memory to the point where people can just totally zone out. This is dangerous, don't do this, but you can totally zone out and get where you're going in a car. It's because your brain doesn't know where the tool ends and you begin. And you can even see this in language, because if somebody is driving, you give them directions, you don't say, okay, now turn the car left. You say, turn left, an imperative sentence. You turn left, because you don't separate, even in the language, the person from the tool. When you are driving the car is an extension of you. When you're playing a video game, nobody says, press the X button so that your character on screen jumps. They just say, press X so you can jump. You, the character on screen. Okay, people do not psychologically separate themselves from their tools, so when they're rolling a die, they think they're doing something. Okay, it's so intuitive and unconscious that people will psychologically respond to die rolling as if you have asked them to actually do something challenging, and they think they can do something. This is also why people try to steer the bowling ball with their bodies. You've seen people do that. It's that same thing. You can't separate the tool from the person. The other is that human beings have evolved to believe they have a tremendous sense of control of the world around them. This is a necessary survival tool, because the human beings who did not believe that they had any control over the world around them didn't bother trying to change their fate, and all were eaten by saber-toothed tigers. Okay, so even in impossible situations where we don't believe we have control, we are evolved to act as if we do. So in some way, in some deeply ingrained part of the brain, when you flip over the card in Candyland and see that it is the color green, somehow you think you did that. And I don't mean consciously. You can say you don't. Like, I know I don't actually have control. But your psychological brain is still squirting the chemicals as if you do. Okay? Which is why it'll feel like a game, even when it's not. And as a game designer, you need to know that, because your end goal is not to make a definitionally correct game by game design standards. It's to make something that feels like a game. Candyland is a game because people think it's a game. The end. Now, this brings me to Woosha's question in the chat that was just posted, and I'm breaking my rules so that I can answer this specific question. Woosh wants to know, is it possible to continue enjoying playing tabletop role-playing games once you know this shit? And the answer is, not as much. That's the honest to God, like, if you get really, really into scenario design, and you really start knowing what you're really doing, you really know Santa doesn't exist, okay? No, you cannot enjoy playing role-playing games anymore. Because these psychological things, they can get broken, okay? If you ask someone to play Candyland with you now, most people, you know, a lot of people will say no, because the day we realize that, you know, actually there's really not, you know, it's, there's no challenge to it, whatever, is the day it stops being fun. Okay. Once you start seeing this stuff, it's not really the same anymore. Okay. You're now the parents on Christmas. You have to find different ways to have fun. And most of that is by the vicarious joy of seeing the children's faces light up because they think Santa exists. Okay. That said, it is still possible to have fun with it. I mean, I know all these tricks. I don't really like playing role-playing games anyway, but then I never did. I've always been a game designer or like a game master, because I don't want to play. People invite me to play, like, you want to play my game? And it's like, no, I don't. I hate playing. Playing sucks. Okay. I want to make games. That's why I got into this in the first place. Okay. And I know all these tricks too. And I can play a game like Metroid Dread and know exactly what it's doing to me and say, oh yeah, there's the trick. And I can still have a good time. And you can sort of shut off your brain and enjoy things like that too. And just be like, you know what? I'm just going to relax and play this game. I know this game isn't very good. And like, but I'm going to enjoy it anyway because I'm having fun. It is possible, but it's never quite the same. The day that you actually beat down your convictions, the day you finally realize, like, you know what? No, the game is actually better off if the players really don't have any agency, but they think they do. Like, the day you figure that out is sort of the day where, like, you know, I don't know if I want to play anymore. I think I just want to make games. It does happen. That said, I can't speak for everyone. I'm really only speaking for myself, and obviously, it's kind of like, can a magician go to a magic show and still enjoy it? Yeah, but they're enjoying it differently, you know. So that's it. That's the answer. And finally, with the few minutes that I have left, Athatos asks about you designing a scenario, and because players always tend to come up with solutions that the scenario designer can't or didn't predict. What can the scenario designer do to mitigate those problems? What the problems that arise when the players find solutions that the scenario designer can't predict? And I'm going to say this now, and this also goes into the whole Santa Claus thing. Number one, if the players are frequently doing things that you as a scenario designer didn't predict, you're a shitty scenario designer. Because it's your job to predict things, and if the players keep catching you by surprise, if you have to say, the players frequently go in directions I didn't expect, then the problem is, you're not really good at predicting player behavior, okay? But the second thing, and this is the thing I'm going to leave you on, because this is a thing that is going to become more apparent through future lessons in the True Scenario Designery course. The second thing is this. Don't leave it up to chance. A really good scenario designer doesn't predict what the players are going to do. A real scenario designer manipulates the players into doing the thing they've already planned for.